Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The writer Salman Rushdie remains in critical condition a week after he was brutally attacked while on stage in Western New York. His life-changing injuries are severe, Rushdie's son said in a statement, but his usual feisty and defiant sense of humor remains intact. The knife attack comes more than 30 years after the Iranian Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini issued a fatwa in 1989 calling for Rushdie's death. That followed the publication of Rushdie's novel, The Satanic Verses. But what was so scary about the novel that a powerful national, religious, and state leader called for a writer's murder? The Satanic Verses refers to an incident in the Prophet Muhammad's life. In Rushdie's book, a character named Mahound appears in dreams. And in one scene, another character tells Mahound, quote, "First we said, Mahound will never compromise, and you compromised. Then we said, Mahound has betrayed us, but you are bringing us a deeper truth. You brought us the devil himself, so that we could witness the workings of the evil one and his overthrow by the right. You have enriched our faith. I am sorry for what I thought." In that scene, Mahound moves away from the sunlight falling through the window and says, "Yes. It was a wonderful thing I did. Deeper truth. Bringing you the devil. Yes, that sounds like me." And for those words, Khomeini wanted Rushdie to die. And last Friday, a knife-wielding fanatic came close to fulfilling that awful wish. After the fatwa was issued, Salman Rushdie spent more than a dozen years in hiding. But by 2012, his life had returned enough to normal that he wrote a memoir about his decade of fear. The memoir, called Joseph Anton, describes with moving candor Rushdie's pain, confusion, and anger at the sometimes absurd lengths he had to go in order to remain safe, even while under the protection of British police. In 2013, I had a chance to speak with Rushdie. He was on the tail end of his book tour for Joseph Anton. And remembering back to that interview, I'm heartbroken now by the beautiful confidence with which he came into our studios. No police protection, just a local guide. No security sweep, no special precautions. He was just a writer who believed that the worst was long behind him. And that defiant sense of humor his son recently mentioned, that defiant sense of humor was there. I remember sitting across the table from him and asking Rushdie if he really did feel safe after all this time. And he laughed and he said, "Well, you don't look that dangerous to me." Well, today, in this podcast special, we're resurfacing my 2013 interview with Salman Rushdie. I started by asking him to read an excerpt of his memoir, Joseph Anton, where Rushdie recounts a moment of terror he experienced at a friend's farm in Wales, one of the first places he fled to while in hiding.
"As for him, he could not be seen at the farm, or its safety would be compromised. There was a farmer who looked after the sheep for Michael and Deb, and at one point he came down off the hill to talk to Michael about something. An ordinary moment became a crisis when invisibility was deemed essential. 'You'd better get out of sight,' Michael told him, and he had to duck down behind a kitchen counter. As he crouched there, listening to Michael get rid of his man as quickly as possible, he felt a sense of deep shame. To hide in this way was to be stripped of all self-respect. To be told to hide was a humiliation. Maybe, he thought, to live like this would be worse than death." In his novel, Shame, he had written about the workings of Muslim honor culture, at the poles of whose moral axis were honor and shame, very different from the Christian narrative of guilt and redemption. He came from that culture, even though he was not religious, and had been raised to care deeply about questions of pride. To skulk and hide was to lead a dishonorable life. He felt very often in those years profoundly ashamed, both shamed and ashamed.
Salman Rushdie, reading an excerpt from Joseph Anton, the 2012 book he wrote about his years in hiding. That particular moment of the book has stayed with me for years. The image of a writer having to cower in terror behind a counter because of the threat posed by religious fanatics. So in our 2013 interview, I asked Rushdie, he had done nothing wrong. So why was he the one who felt ashamed?
Because there's nothing at all dignified about it. You know, it feels cowardly. Feels running away from something, feels unmanly. It has all kinds of very strong, you know, emotional triggers. And I hated doing it. And I mean, the reason on that particular occasion that I had to do it was that I didn't want to bring danger to my friends whose farm it was.
Right.
You know? And if the story got out that they were sheltering me, you know, then they could have been in danger. This was, remember, at the very, very beginning of all this, when the temperature was very, very high, and this was headline news on every television and radio station.
I mean, you had become one of the most famous men in the world overnight because of it.
I mean, there was this extraordinary moment, I remember, when I got out of the armored Jaguar at a gas station because I needed to go to the bathroom, and literally every head at the gas station jerked round, you know, and I thought, That was quite alarming.
But the scene in Wales, what really gets me is it's not because, you know, a potential fanatic is at the door. It's the sheep farmer who's on the land, that even someone like that seeing you was considered a grave danger.
Well, just because they didn't want the story to get out of where I was, you know, because we didn't, though in those early days, we really had no idea what was coming at us. You know, there was no way of knowing how big the attack would be and how big the danger was to people.
Well, how often did you have to move, and where did you go? Where did you go in those early weeks and months?
Well, the early weeks were very, very disruptive, because one of the things that was bizarre about this whole thing was that I was never provided with a house to go to, you know, because the police, I mean, I know there was a kind of public belief that I was being offered these things called government safe houses, mm-hmm. you know, which exist in the novels of John le Carré, but as far as I'm concerned, I never saw one,
right.
You know. And they made it very clear to me that it was up to me to find places to go, and at the same time that I was supposed to be invisible. I mean, that's a very strange double bind, you know. I mean, invisible man rents house. It's not, you know, it's not easy to do. And so I had to call friends, and people had to go and rent cottages for me and so on. So there was I don't think I was anywhere for more than, I mean, the longest I was somewhere was for a couple of weeks at that
right.
time.
You know, in the book you write about how in reality, there's no such thing as an ordinary life. And you quote, or you mention that how surrealists say that our ability to experience the world is dulled by habituation. Mm. But I wonder, with the tumult and the uncertainty and the fear in those early weeks and months after the fatwa had been imposed upon you, you must have yearned for that habituation.
I mean, very much so. It's one of the strange things about the kind of the other end of the story is that when I actually, you know, when I was released from the clutches of the police web, you know, and allowed to regain an ordinary life, you know, you might have thought that after a decade of being denied it, it would be quite difficult, you know, to mm-hmm. adjust back. But actually, I surprised myself that I adjusted back like within a day. Within a day, I was hailing taxis and going to the supermarket and, you know, behaving like it never happened. And what it taught me was really that our desire for ordinary life is so deep, you know, the denial of it is such a trauma that when we're given it back, we just grab it, you know, as something very precious.
Ferociously, in fact. Now, you mentioned that you weren't granted any safe houses by the British government, but you were given security, a protection detail for just about all of the time that you had to be in hiding. I mean, there's this question of ordinariness, but also dignity and indignity and some of the ordinary things that you had to negotiate with your security team in order to feel like you were living a dignified life.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing was that there was a great division in Scotland Yard, let's say, between the officers who were actually with me on the job, who were very sympathetic and supportive and did everything they could to sort of ease the situation for me, and the higher-up officers back at the yard, who were often sort of actually politically hostile, you know, and sort of annoyed that they had to do this, mm-hmm. and felt that I'd sort of brought it on myself and was a big nuisance. But the ones with me were, I mean, they're trained in being a little self-effacing, because it's not just me. Everybody who receives this kind of protection finds the intrusion into their private life very difficult.
Right.
You know, I mean, I talked to Tony Blair about it once, and when he became prime minister, he had small children, and it was very difficult just doing what you have to do with your children, like getting them to school and so on.
Right. Well, you had children too, and you weren't even able to see them.
Well, you know, it was one of the things we had to do was at least create the illusion that I wasn't able to see my son, you know, because we didn't want to bring the danger in that direction. So there was a kind of public fiction that I couldn't see him, and behind that public fiction, I occasionally could see him.
Right.
But it was very difficult. It required all kinds of, you know, shenanigans.
Yeah, because you just write about it so grippingly, and how you had created a system where you were to call to check in on him and his mother. And there was one night where you called and called and called, and nobody answered. And you said it was the worst night of your life.
Well, it was terrifying, because we had made this agreement, his mother and I, that I would call at certain time of the evening to talk to him, and that if they weren't going to be home, that they would leave a message for me on my answering machine, I guess. And on this particular evening, they weren't home and there was no message. And initially I thought, well, they're just late, you know. But then as time went by, I got more and more and more worried, and eventually told the protection officers who were with me that I was worried. And they sent a car. They called the London police and got them to do a drive-by. And the news came back, was absolutely heart-stopping, which said that the front door is open and all the lights are on. I mean, at that point, you can imagine that your thoughts spiral off into dreadful calamity.
Right.
You know, and the police said that they had to, the phrase they used was assemble an army to go in there, because they didn't know what they'd find. And I was sort of manically dialing the number like a crazy person, you know. And then after about 40 minutes, suddenly my son answered the phone. And they had been at some event at school and been delayed, and his mother had forgotten to leave a message. And I said, well, what do you mean? What about the front door being open and all the lights being on? And it turned out that the police car that drove by had looked at the wrong house.
The shocking thing about that is that on an ordinary day, in an ordinary life, that would be an ordinary mistake.
Yeah.
And yet, of course, you were thrown into the spiral of thinking they're probably dead.
Yes.
There's a couple other things about those early days of your life in hiding that I would just love to dig into mm-hmm. a little bit more. And one of them is that, you know, we were talking about your son. You had promised him that you were going to publish a book. And you did, in 1990?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So
a children's
book called Harun and the Sea of Stories. And I was just looking back at the beginning of it, and I saw a line in it that said, describing a city that plays a central role in the book, and you write that it's a sad city, the saddest of cities, a city so ruinously sad it had forgotten its name.
Mm.
And did you write this while you were in hiding?
Yes, I did. It was the first. It was my way back to writing, really.
I mean, was that you basically describing in part your experience?
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, it starts from a sad place and it ends in a happy place, because it's a children's book. You know, it actually has a fully fledged happy ending, which is the first time I was ever able to come up with one of those. And I guess happy endings had become important to me at the time, you know. But it's true that, I mean, I felt that there were so many ordinary life things that I couldn't do with my son at that time, that this promise that I'd made to write a book that he would enjoy, that was one I'd better keep. And I'm glad in a way that existed, because it gave me the motivation and incentive to go back to my job, mm-hmm. you know, and to, in a way, to rediscover my love of my job, you know, because that had been very shaken by what happened.
Right. And this idea of a city being ruinously sad and having forgotten its name, because, I mean, you had been disconnected from your normal life.
And
you had
my name.
And your name, exactly.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Joseph Anton is the pseudonym mm-hmm. that you were asked to create.
Yeah, so that we could rent houses in it, and I could write checks in it, and even more than that, that the police could train themselves, the protection teams could train themselves not to accidentally use my real name when they were in the neighborhood of where I was staying. And so if somebody overheard my name, they could work out where I was. Mm-hmm. So they had to train themselves to use this pseudonym. So it was more or less, it was mainly for them. But I always detested having to do it and was deeply relieved when the day came that I didn't have to. And I thought the reason for making it the title of the book is just to say to people, imagine how odd it is. Imagine how bizarre it would be to live in a world in which you had to give up your name.
Right. Well, speaking of bizarre, there are aspects of this story which are both... I keep calling it a story, but it is your life, which are both sort of farcical and fury-inducing because, you know, while all this is happening to you, especially in the first weeks and months, I mean, you write about how, for example, the Archbishop of Canterbury said he, quote, understood Muslims' feelings. And the British Foreign Secretary at the time, Geoffrey Howe, said that the book, The Satanic Verses, had been rude to Britain. And that it was the Ayatollah's government that had cut off relations with the UK, not the other way around. Mm-hmm. I wonder how that changed your view of the country you'd made your home at that time.
Well, it wasn't just the country. It was a kind of religious gang. You know, so if you were to look at the religious leaders, not just in England, you know, I mean, yes, in England there was this unfortunate remark by the Archbishop of Canterbury, but also by the chief rabbi. Of Britain. Meanwhile, something very similar was being said by the Cardinal of New York, you know, by Jimmy Carter, you know, by people around the world. And you began to realize that this group of people who all believe in different religions, you know, when a religion says it's under attack, they all join up on that team.
And the God Squad,
The God Squad. I'm afraid it really exists. And it made me feel even more contemptuous of it than I did before.
Yeah. Well, there's also another moment. It's farcical, almost, is the only word that comes to my mind, is when you were in hiding and the police had tried to convince you to wear a wig.
Yeah.
And you tried it out on Sloane Street in London, and man, you overhear a man saying, look, there's that bastard Rushdie in a wig.
Yeah.
I mean, there had to be 1,000 moments where you wanted to throw up your arms and say, this is ridiculous. Yeah, what am I doing here?
I mean, there was this strange quality, like this wig episode, that life had, that it was simultaneously funny and not funny at all. I mean, like, at the same time, it was both things. And the wig episode is like that. I mean, I could see that was funny, you know, but at the same time, I could see that it was kind of, you know, awful to be asked to walk outside Harrods department store with a stupid piece of hair on my head, as if that was going to make me invisible somehow.
Right. And in fact, the reason why it struck me in particular is because, you know, the full fatwa that the Ayatollah had declared said that the Satanic Verses is against Islam, and all those involved in its publication who were or aware of its content are sentenced to death. And in fact, your Japanese editor had been murdered.
Translator
had been murdered. Yeah. And other translators had been attacked.
No, I mean, you know, the fact is that all those included publishers, translators, booksellers, you know, and there were attacks on all of those. You know, there were pipe bombs and fire bombs in bookstores in this country and in many other countries.
And riots in several other countries.
Yeah, no, and, you know, the Japanese translator, Professor Igarashi, was murdered at his university when he was working late one night. And the Italian translator, Ettore Capriolo, was left for dead after an attack and fortunately survived. And my Norwegian publisher, William Nygaard, was shot 3 times in the back and miraculously made a full recovery, but, you know, wasn't expected to. So this was a really serious global attack. And in many ways, I was the best protected person of all those who were vulnerable, you know, and it was easier to attack these soft targets.
Do you ever feel a sense of vulnerability now?
No, you don't look that dangerous to me.
You don't see what I've got under the table here, no. Well, I'm glad you feel safe in this studio. But, I mean, do you?
No, not really. Not really. I mean, it's been over, you know, as you've seen, the sort of very end moment of this was, now almost 12 years ago. You know, I mean, it's actually been over for longer than it went on for.
Right.
And you know, we live in an age in which the subject changes very fast, you know, and this is such an old subject that now people have many other things to be agitated about.
Maybe perhaps by a certain degree, but you know, you've also written that works of art, even works of entertainment, do not come into being in a social and political vacuum, mm-hmm. right? And that the way they operate in society cannot be separated from politics, from history,
yep.
for every text a context, right? That's from you. You wrote that back in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
Others might say that, you know, that in fact what you experienced in 89 and the following 12 years is now sort of writ large around the world.
I mean, I tried to say it in the book myself, because I do believe that what happened to me and to the other people attacked was a sort of prologue, you know, that it was like the first very visible stirring of the phenomenon of Islamic fanaticism, which later, of course, exploded onto a much, much bigger stage.
My 2013 conversation with Salman Rushdie. Rushdie never backed down from his defense of free speech. He became even more vocal about it in the past several years. In fact, just a few weeks before he was attacked in New York, Rushdie gave an interview to the German news magazine Stern. In it, he said, "The biggest danger facing us right now is that we lose our democracy. Today's greatest danger facing us is this kind of crypto-fascism that we see in America and elsewhere. Death threats have become more normal. Not only politicians get them, even American teachers who have had to take certain books off the syllabus." "Oh, we live in scary times," Rushdie went on. "That's true enough, even though I always tell people, don't be afraid." I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.